ॐ भद्रं कर्णे विष्णुयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यचत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः त्यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्तश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तारक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्थधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. We went through the first half of this verse last week, and we'll just review that and then finish up with the Paravidya. So repeat after me. Tatra para rigvedo yajurvedaha samavedo atarvavedaha Sikshakalpo Vyakaranam Niruktam Chando Jyotishamiti Atatparayaya Tiraksharam Adigamyate Tatapra Rigvedo Yajurveda Samaveda Atharvavedaha Sikshakalpo Vyakaranam Niruktam Chanto Jyotishamiti Ataparayaya Tadaksharam Adigamyate. Now, in even the previous verse, it says, Dve Vidye Veditavye, there's two knowledges to be known. The knowers of Brahman, the Brahmavids, the knowers of the ones who know the Brahmavids are the ones who know the Vedas, the truth of which, the core of which, is knowledge of the Paramatma. It's from the Bhashya. Brahmavids, Brahmaviddha Bhavanti. So the Brahmavids, they say, there are two knowledges to be known. Paracha eva aparacha. Paravidya and aparavidya. The apara, para is sometimes called the higher, apara is called the lower. So in the next verse, it went through and gave a list of really what comprises the apara vidya, the lower knowledge. And that was all four Vedas, Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda. And then also it went and gave the six Sharangas, which are those limbs, the supporting knowledges that one needs to know in order to be able to really study and learn the Vedas. That one was siksha, was the rules of pronunciation, how the sounds are made. Kalpa are the rules for performing the rituals, how to use the mantras, exactly what to do to perform a ritual. Vyakaranam is the grammar, Sanskrit grammar, the Panini Sutras. And before, actually Panini actually put the Sanskrit grammar into an order, a grammar that was always there. He didn't invent the grammar. He just put the grammar into a brilliant, brilliant order, and that's called the Panini Sutras. But those are the Vyakaran and the Sanskrit grammar. Niruktam is the etymology of the words, taking all of the words back to their core meanings. Once you break the words up into their dhatus, their verbal roots, with what we call the upasargas, the prefixes, and then the affixes, all of these put together will make a word. But all of these will have meanings of their own, right? And so you have to break the word back down into its component parts and to really understand the meaning. So that would be similar to what we call the etymology of a word. Chandas are the different meters for chanting. And Jyotisham is the astrology. Astronomy and astrology together. But they don't make a differentiation there. So these were looked at last week. What this list is meant to encompass, really, is knowledge of the world. Right? So the Vedas themselves, you learn the Vedas, you learn how to do mantras, everything that you, and you learn that you learn grammar and etymology and how to do the rituals, how to pronounce all of these things for understanding the Vedas. That's really for gaining and grasping samsara. And how, samsara means what is going on within the creation and how to live properly within this creation. So there's a lot of knowledge to be gained, right, about what this creation is and how to live within it. And the four Vedas will really encompass that for you. And we can add a lot of other knowledges to it, like mathematics and biology and on and on and on, all of the sciences. That all has to do, those all of those knowledges have to do with our understanding of the nature of the world that we are living in and experiencing through our sense organs. Now, so what I'm trying to do is just if you were to bring this knowledge up to the present and even take it back into the past, what we're doing with this delineation of aparavidya is to show you really the knowledges that can be gained within samsara, right? Within the creation. Let's not say samsara, within the creation. Within the creation that has to do with means and ends. Right? I need to do this, and by means and ends, what this boils down to is this, if we're looking at it in terms of the Vedas. I need to do this in order to be relatively happy. I need to behave in this way in order to be relatively happy. I need to do this in this way, dharmically, in order to achieve my desires so that I can be happy. But it's a guidebook. The Rig Veda is a guidebook in the sense of all of the Vedas, starting with the Rig Veda. They're guidebooks telling you what is going on with this world and how I should behave in the world, right? In order to have relative shanti, in order to have a mind that is really... has at its highest value dharma, or a mind that is ruled by dharma, and a mind that is relating to the universe, living within the universe in the way that the universe is, so that you're not experiencing beating your head against the wall. Whereas if you're living within the universe according to the rules of the universe, you will have relative shanti. Another way, simple way of saying it is if you're following dharma, you know, the basic laws of the universe, your mind will enjoy a relative peace. Not an absolute peace, because it's still a fact that for an ajnani, somebody that doesn't have self-knowledge, my ananda is something to be achieved out here, and I don't have any understanding, really, of the underlying identity of myself, the world, and the creation. And so there's an isolation and a separation that is built in to the jiva. As long as you take yourself to be this body, mind, sense organs, you can follow dharma and enjoy relative shanti. You can follow the Vedas and have relative peace. But it's not going to be an absolute peace, because relativity by nature is fraught with peril. It's fraught with death. It's fraught with change by its very nature. And there's nothing you can do about that. But you can just live in it in a way that gives you a relative peace. You can be a saintly person, a loving saintly person, but in your mind, until you have self-knowledge, you are a loving, saintly, limited person, different from Bhagavan. Okay? And that difference, if you read the lives of the saints, whether in really any tradition, their suffering is in their separation from the Lord, their sense of separation from the Lord, and they're always struggling to have that experience of unity. That's the key right there. They're always struggling and working to have the experience of unity and oneness with the Lord. And when that experience of unity seems to wane, they feel extreme pain. So there often be, if you read the poets, the poetry of the saints, that's often what the subject matter is going to be. Is always working to maintain and keep that sense of unity with the beloved, which is the Atma. So this first part of this what we call the aparavidya is dealing with this world really of dharma and adharma. Okay. if I can just simplify it like that. Then it says, Atta, so having delineated the upara vidya, Atta now, para, the para vidya. Yaya, Atta para, yaya, that now the para vidya, yaya, by which. This is a feminine a pronoun. Instrumental singular, yaya, by which, you know, we did shalaya, this is yaya, okay, shalaya, yaya, by which, okay, right, instrumental singular, so by which, because vidya is a feminine noun, so you see that para, vidya, para is an adjective, so para, vidya, that vidya which is para, which is the higher vidya, so vidya feminine. That vidya, that paravidya, yaya, by which, tad aksharam, that which is aksharam, indestructible, adigamyate, is gained. Adigamyate means is gained. So that paravidya, by which, tad aksharam, that which is aksharam, that which is indestructible, it's a word for Brahman, that Brahman which is aksharam, that, you know, because we're talking about the Brahmavids from earlier. Let me go back to that and tell you. In the first verse, it says, Sa Brahmavidyam, that knowledge of Brahman, right, was taught by Brahmaji. Right, that knowledge of Brahman was taught by Brahmaji to his eldest son, Atharva. So here the vidya that we're dealing with is Brahma vidya. So that Brahma vidya, so para vidya, is the Brahma vidya, right? So that knowledge of Brahman is the para vidya. That Brahman is aksharam. So aksharam is an adjective, in a sense, to Brahman. Brahman is that which cannot be destroyed or changed in any way. So, tad aksharam Brahman, that Brahman, adigamyate, is gained by that paravidya, okay, by that knowledge. Okay, so now, this means, what the Upanishad is telling you, there's this aparavidya, which includes all of the Vedas. And I touched on this a little bit at the end last week. There's this aparavidya. It includes all of the Vedas and all of the Vedangas, like astrology, etc., all of them. Now, the Upanishads are part of the Vedas. They're not something separate. So even for somebody who's learning the rituals or a Vaidika, they will learn the whole Veda, which includes the Vedanta, which includes the Upanishads. And so now, in this, the doubt comes, this Upanishad is differentiating paravidya from aparavidya. And the Upanishads, which are part of the Vedas, are included in the aparavidya. And so now, where are you going to put the paravidya? Right? Because the Upanishads are what give knowledge of Brahman. That's what they deal with, the Upanishads. And this itself is an Upanishad. So what differentiates the paravidya, this higher knowledge, from the aparavidya, which includes all the Upanishads? And this is what it is. It's the teaching methodology. When a person learns the Vedas, the Vaidika, just as somebody who performs all of the rituals and is working for means and ends. In other words, I do a ritual so I can have a child. Or I do a ritual so I can go to Swargaloka. Or so that I can become rich. Or I can become healthy or whatever. I'm doing my rituals and living my life to gather punya so I can go to heaven. That's somebody who's living within samsara. The Vaidika, who learns this first portion of the Vedas, will learn the Vedanta, the Upanishads also. And when they're performing their rituals, they will even chant the Upanishads as part of the ritual. As they're doing an offering, they might be chanting the Taittiriya Upanishad, right? As they're doing a ritual offering. So these Upanishads are very much part of the Vedas. They're studied and they're learned. But the words are studied. The words are learned. The words are not studied in that guru-sisha relationship, which is meant when the Upanishads are used in order to make the student have a cognition of the nature of Brahman, of the nature of yourself. So the paravidya, they're talking about the paravidya, they're not talking about you learning the Upanishads and memorizing them. Because that's done by everybody in the Vedic tradition who's studying the Vedas. They learn and memorize all of it. All of the Upanishads also. So the paravidya is not your study of the Upanishads. It's not your memorization of the Upanishads or your use of the Upanishads. It's the cognition of the vision which the Upanishads have to give. So it's the what we call the aparoksha jnanam. It's the immediate, direct knowledge of yourself as Brahman, the recognition of which is given through the guru-sisha relationship that takes place, right, at the time of teaching. That is why in this Upanishad, they start out with the sampradaya, right? They give the sampradaya. This went from Brahmaji to Atharva to Angiras, down to all the way down to Shaunaka. Okay? They give the whole sampradaya. And when they get to Shaunaka, they talk then about Shaunaka being a Mahashala. A Mahashala is somebody who has done and lived a Vedic life, who has performed rituals, who has followed Dharma, who has given all charities, done all of the things that are expected of him as a Vedika. Right? That's what makes him a Mahashala. Now the connection there is this person who has now come, right? So he already knows all of the Upanishads. Right? He knows all of the Vedas, he knows all of the Upanishads, he knows how to do rituals, he knows what Dharma is. He's lived a Dharmic life, he's lived a Vedic life. He now comes to the teacher and asks the teacher for this knowledge according to Viddhi. Right? He comes according to Viddhi, as it is proper, as it is enjoined, sticks in hand, you know, in a traditional way, he approaches the guru and asks for this knowledge. He asks the teacher a question. What is that thing knowing which everything is known? So now he comes to the teacher. He already knows the Upanishads. So why is this sampradaya being told? Well, because what is being highlighted is that for paravidya, right, because this is the teacher who's teaching this, he starts by telling the sampradaya, right? And now he says, those who know the Brahmavids, they say, what the Brahmavids say, is that there are two knowledges that you have to know, the aparavidya and the paravidya. Shaunaka knows the aparavidya. He knows the Vedas, he's a Mahashala, he's lived a Vedic life. That needs to be known and understood. Why? Because, as we see, in order for the paravidya to be gained, a certain adhikaritvam is necessary. The student has to be a qualified student to get this knowledge. What makes the student a qualified student? We would say that for somebody living within the Vedic society, the Vedas themselves, all of the rules or the lifestyle laid out for a Vedika, somebody who's living a Vedic life, holds the mind in check. It gives them a structure that allows Dharma to predominate. Right? If the Dharma becomes predominant, that mind enjoys a certain level of relative shanti. The mind that enjoys a level of relative shanti is a mind that's available for this knowledge. That's number one. Number two, in Vedic life, there's also a lot of ahimsa. Ahimsa is a very high value, means non-injury. And for those who take sannyasa also, the key value in sannyasa is ahimsa, non-injury. Another way of talking about ahimsa is really kindness to all beings. That's the vow that they take. And that idea of ahimsa predominates the Vedic culture, kindness to all beings. And so that value of kindness to all beings is what creates, as a sadhana, having that value as a sadhana, is really what creates a mature person, right? A psychologically and spiritually mature person. So a person who has this value of, practice this value of ahimsa, and has followed the structured life of the Vedic life, which is structured in terms of keeping the person's within the boundaries of Dharma. We don't have that same type of structure here. So hopefully, you know, our family, our parents, our society in some way gives us a structure. I talked a little bit about this last week. A structure that contains you within a value system that makes you have Dharma as a stronger value in your life than your immediate pleasure. Because if Dharma is not a stronger value than your immediate pleasure, of course you'll go after your immediate pleasure. And if you go after your immediate pleasure at the expense of Dharma, then you're going to find your mind in a lot of pain and conflict. Okay? If there's not, Jung once said, you know, the face that you give the world is the face it gives back to you. And he said it in the other way too, the face that you give your psyche. And this is maybe perhaps even more profound. Both are profound, but I love this. The face that you give your own psyche, your own unconscious, is the face that it gives back to you. So just think that it's all ahimsa. It's all it all rotates around this kindness to all beings. The kindness that you give your own psyche is what it reflects back to you. The kindness that you give to others is what is reflected back to you. And so kindness to all beings, or ahimsa, is really the primary sadhana for your own well-being. And that's why, you know, Swamiji's book, Value of Values, is such an important book, because what you understand with each of the values that it goes through from the Bhagavad Gita in that chapter 13, each value that it goes through, it tells you why this value is to your advantage. Of course, the world benefits from those values also. But what you need, what a person, every person needs to realize is the own personal benefit that you gain from that value, from the practice of that value. So that personal benefit is something that is greater than the secondary benefit of the object or thing or situation that you were after. So then the Dharma, or the value, becomes more of a value than pursuing a given object, because the practice it's the practice of that value or that attitude that gives you the peace or the love or the happiness that you seek. And the practice of the secondary object, let me have this so I can be happy, actually doesn't really give you any kind of lasting happiness. It doesn't really give you any happiness at all if you're going against your Dharma. If you're going against Dharma in order to gain the object because you think it'll make you happy, in fact, you just feel sick inside. And we've all had this, our little experiences of that. Right? We've had our challenges. So we realize that. But the more a person comes to understand what is actually going on with the psyche, that it's really kindness to all beings, or the face that you give to others is the face that you get back, and the face that you give to your own psyche is the face that you give back. That knowledge results in your own, it blesses you with your own maturity. That knowledge is what, the knowledge, that understanding is what allows the psyche to grow into a dikari, into a mind that has relative happiness. And so because of that, this apara vidya is considered to be very important. It's not something that is just dismissed as this isn't knowledge, that this is important. No, there's two vidyas to be known. One we call the lower. You can also look at lower as that which creates the foundation you know, like the basement, or the foundation, creates the foundation on which this higher can be, that can rest, so that the mind can is free then to gain, to really gain that knowledge and to hold it. That's important also, because Swamiji's often use this. I don't know if he uses this anymore. He used to use it. For a mind that's not prepared for knowledge, the teacher can do wonders, especially somebody like that. I have to always give credit to Swamiji for his extraordinary sense of humor. Right? He can, when he gives a talk, no matter what level, right, even that whether we're studying in Coimbatore, studying the Brahma Sutras, or he's talking to a group of householders who are coming to just understand Dharma, really. He will tell jokes and put your mind into a relaxed state of well-being. Now, there's nothing like laughing. You know? He'll make you laugh and make your mind relax. So he'll give you momentary adhikaritvam, right? So that your mind is in a condition of relaxation, not worried, not concerned, not worried about all the things that you don't have, or all of the slights that so-and-so has done to you, all of these things that just build up and fester inside. Even in your own life, you know, you can wipe that away for a minute. Even if all that's happening, you can do things to kind of get rid of it momentarily. Well, the teacher can do that for you too. You just clear the slate for a minute. So this mind is for the moment just relaxed. And then this knowledge can be slipped in. You know, so that then when the teaching is taking place, you see it and you appreciate it. And then when you walk out the door and, you know. All the samsara comes back. And I've told the story so often that when I was first listening to Swamiji, right, in India, I'd get such a beautiful clearance and all was well. And then I would walk out of the lecture hall, and as soon as I stepped out of the lecture hall, you know, it would start. The closure would start. And by the time I made it up to my room, I was just... It's very unfortunate. So I remember so clearly one day thinking, someday I will make it all the way back up to my room without that happening. And that did happen. That did happen. Right. But what I'm saying is that, so he used to use this example that a mind that is not prepared is when it gains this knowledge is kind of like a paper bag, you know, getting a bunch of coals, trying to carry, you know, a bag of coals, a bunch of coals in a paper bag. And of course the paper bag just burns right through and the coals just splatter, right? So like that, this knowledge coming into a mind that is not prepared for it closes over as though, right? And so the first part of the Vedas, just really the life of Dharma, right? Learning how to be with your mind, learning how to be with others, learning how to be kind to self and others. That gives you a mind that then has relative shanti, relatively knows how to take care of itself. That's the thing. It relatively knows how to take care of itself by the way it relates to itself and to its own unconscious and the way it relates to the world. When it learns that, then that mind has the relative strength. Relative ego structure, strength of ego, not in a negative way, I don't mean at all. A strong, you know, sense of self, you know, stable. And then that mind is very easily able to handle this knowledge. So that apara vidya is very, very important. Now, with that apara vidya, so that's the connection there. With that apara vidya, this para vidya can be gained. Right? So the apara vidya becomes useful for the antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind. And then the para vidya is that knowledge, you know, by which that which is aksharam, the aksharam brahman, is gained. So that's the connection. Now, remember the connection for the Aksharam Brahman, right? Is the student's question to the teacher. Shanaka's question is, what is that knowing which everything is as well known? Right? What is that? And so now, having delineated, told what the aparavidya is and what the introducing the paravidya, right? Now he goes on to define it. So the teaching is really starting now. He's going to go on and define exactly what is this aksharam. Aksharam Brahman. So let's take a look at that. Yet tadadresham, agrahim, agotram, avarnam, chakshushrotram, tadapanipadam, nityam vibhum, sarvagatam susukshmam, tad avyayam, yadbhutayonim, paripashyanti dhiraha. Sandhi. Yet tat adresham agrahyam agotram avaranam achakshus. The word is, yeah, you see there is achakshuhu, it's from achakshus. Shrotram, tat, apani, padam. Nityam, vibhum, sarva, gatam. Susukshman, tat, avyayam, yet, bhutayonim, paripashyanti, dhiraha. Okay. So now the yet tat at the beginning, that which, yet tat, that which, it's referring back to the previous verse, tad aksharam brahma, that aksharam brahman, right? Which the Brahmavids know. So, yet tad, that aksharam brahman. Now look at the last two words in the verse. Paripashyanti dhiraha. The dhiras, those, the vivekinaha, those who have this knowledge, that have this viveka, those really who know Brahman, right? That's the vivekinaha. Those who have made this discrimination, who actually know the nature of the self, those dhiraha, those wise person, people who have viveka, that ability to discriminate, they paripashyanti. Pashyanti means they see. Pari means they see completely. Pari means if something is pashyanti, you see something. If it's paripashyanti, you see all the way around it. You see the whole thing completely. That's why sometimes this knowledge is said, so this knowledge rests, if for a jnani, for a wise person, rests on the hand like an amalaka fruit. An amalaka fruit is just a little round fruit. If you put that little round fruit on your hand, you see the whole thing. Right? You don't just see part of it, you see the whole there. That's paripashyanti. You see the whole thing very clearly. So the dhirahas, those who have the viveka, those wise people, those jnanis, the Brahmavids, paripashyanti, they see this wholly, completely. They see that aksharam brahman, which is yad, which is adrashyam. Adrashyam is Vedic, it means adrishyam. Adrishyam means that which cannot be seen as an object. Drish, the root drish means to see, right? Adrishyam means that which is not objectifiable, cannot be seen through your sense organs. So it just uses the eyes here, but the eyes stand for all sense organs. It means adrishyam. Brahman, the aksharam brahman, that which, knowing which all things are known, that brahman, that aksharam brahman, knowing which all things are known, that aksharam brahman is not something you can see through your sense organs. It's not an object of sensory perception, adrisham. Okay? Also, agrahyam. Remember when you put a in front of a noun, it negates it. Grahyam is something that can be grasped, right? That can be touched, that can be held. So here, not only is Brahman something that you cannot see or experience through your sense organs, cannot be objectified through your sense organs. Sense organs means your eyes, your ears, your sense of touch, your sense of taste, your sense of smell, the five sense organs. It's not something that can be perceived through the five sense organs. Nor through the organs of action can it be grasped. The organs of action, you can't do anything to it. You can't grasp it. You can't walk. The organs of action are your hands, your feet, your speech, your sexuality, and your ability to evacuate. These are the things the body can do. Brahman is not an object which you can relate to in a physical way. You can't grasp it. You can't kick it. You can't evacuate it. You can't have sex with it. You can't, you know, talk to it as an object. It's not objectifiable for your karmendriyas, the organs of action, nor is it objectifiable for your sense organs. So remember, as a human being, as a jiva, right? If we look at the component parts of the jiva, we have five sense organs that they've just dealt with, and we have five organs of action, right? So Brahman is not a sense object, nor is it an object that we can relate to in a physical way. Everybody see that? Okay, so it's adresham, which is the same as adrisham, agrahyam, agotram. In India, the agotra is a person. Every Indian will have a lineage. Their gotra will be the lineage. You know, they were born of such and such parents. Were born of such and such parents. There's a lineage that goes all the way back to the first rishi. And so, in fact, the gotra for an Indian is extremely important for doing rituals and whatnot. They'll always, as part of the ritual, when they're making their sankalpa, the resolve for what they want to achieve for the ritual, this gotra will be included, their gotra will be included in the ritual. And so for a person to have lost their gotra, you know, for that somehow, just for whatever reasons, in over the passage of time, the gotra was lost. It's a tragedy. That's an incredible loss for a Hindu to lose the gotra. But what the gotra stands for is this process of birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. It's the lineage of your birth. The lineage of your birth. Brahman has no gotra. Brahman has not been born. Right? So to say that Brahman is a gotram is the same as saying Brahman is free from birth. There is no birth, no beginning for for Brahman. Okay? Remember, for the gotra takes everything back to the first rishi, to the beginning of the creation. And so for Brahman, there is no such lineage because Brahman is free from birth. So I think Swamiji in his translation just says unborn. But if you read his bhasha, his commentary on it, he will actually go into what that means, why unborn. Because why would you say unborn when you say a gotra? Because gotra is all about a person, the lineage of a person's birth. Okay? Brahman has no gotra, so he's unborn. So a gotram. Avaranam. Avaranam has two meanings, probably more. Varna is that the description we use. Varna is the description we use to define something. Like, for instance, it's often called color. Like, we can differentiate something by its color or by its form. That's varna. We can also describe something by its size. That's varna. So the characteristics which we use to describe something are called varna. Brahman is a varna. He has no characteristics, right? He has no color. He's not red or blue or white or black. He has no size. He's not big or large. These type of descriptions belong to something that can be objectified. Like that's an object of perception or something I can touch or feel. Then we can give them this type of characteristics. But Brahman is not as something objectifiable that can have these type of colors or characteristics or can be size. Now the second, so that's primary. In fact, it is this meaning that Shankara uses in his Bhasha. But Varna also means a person's Varna is their caste. Whether the person is a Brahmana, Kshatriya, you know, Vaishya or Shudra. The caste system, the four castes, are called the four Varnas. So if we take it that way also, since we say that Shankara is a Gotra, I mean that Brahman is a Gotra, no Gotra, he also has no caste. Right? So we have to bring in both of those. And Swamiji and his Bhasha does bring in both. But no caste, right? So you can't say about the Atman, the self, you're a Brahmana. Or, oh, you poor thing, you're a Shudra. You know? Or we're all Mlechas.
We're what?
We're Mlechas. Because we're not part of the, we're not born in India, and we're not born within the Vedic system. So Mlechas are those who are outside of the system. So Brahman is not a Mlecha either. Right? And he's not a Westerner either. He's not an Easterner. He's not a Westerner.
Brahman, California.
And Brahman's not a Hindu either. He's not a Vaidika either. Right? He's not a Christian or a Jew either. He doesn't have a caste. And he doesn't have a gotra. He doesn't have a color. And he doesn't have a size. He's avarnam. Okay? Avarnam. So varna really, and if you take the whole meaning of the word, it's that those things which are used to describe something. Brahman cannot be described. He's not an object that is subject to description or categorization. Right? That's avarnam. Then the next one. Now, also, a chakshushrotram, this is a compound. If you look at above, it said adresham. Adresham, or for adresham, adresham means it can't be perceived by the sense organs. Then he goes on to say, so now we know Brahman is not an object of perception. But now it says Brahman also is not the hearer or the seer, you know. A shrotra, chakshus means eyes, someone who sees. Brahman has no eyes. He has no eyes. He's a chakshus. He's without eyes. He's a shrotra. He's without ears. So he can't see and he can't hear. Okay. This negates namarupa. Rupa, form, is what is perceived by the eyes. Right? Form, color, that's rupa. Nama, name, that's what is heard. This whole creation falls under this. Nama rupa, name and form. Brahman has no ears and he has no eyes. So Brahman is not a seer or a hearer. It's not only that Brahman, this is very important, this is what people miss this. It's not just that Brahman is not an object to be seen or heard or touched. It's not an object to be seen, we'll stay with seen or heard for now. Seen or heard or felt, any of the five senses. He's not an object. Nor is Brahman a seer or a hearer. He has no eyes. He has no ears. He has no sense of touch. He has no sense of taste. None of the sense organs. Brahman is without the sense organs. This is going to become very important, and the reason this is maybe brought up now, at least from how the Bhasha deals with it. The end of this particular chapter, they talk about Brahman as Brahmavit, right? As Sarvavit and Sarvagnaha. Brahman is a Sarvavit and Sarvagnaha, one who has all knowledge. Brahman is Ishwara, Ishwara having all knowledge. Then you think, well, Brahman, if Brahman is, you know, a Sarvagnaha, has all knowledge, Sarvavit, has all knowledge in particular, he must have sense organs. Brahman must have ears to hear and eyes to see. And so before we get there, they want to cover that right away. Brahman has no ears to hear or eyes to see. Particular sense organs are not necessary in order for there to be total knowledge of the creation. But the main point here is, like, you gain knowledge. When you think of yourself as a jiva, you think of yourself as somebody who sees, someone who hears, someone who thinks, right? Someone who feels. You're a doer on all, you're a knower on all of these different levels. You perform the act of knowing. Right? Your identification is with yourself as a knower. So your identification with your Atma, the Atma, is going to be with yourself as somebody who knows. I know you and you know me. I hear you, you hear me. And so the knowership is something very ingrained to your sense of self. And so now right at the start, they say Brahman is neither an object nor subject. Subject, object, let me put it this way, more clear. Brahman is neither the knower nor the known. Neither knower or known. Look in this creation. You're a knower, you're a knower, you're a knower, I'm a knower, everybody's a knower, and then all the things that are known. So the knower-known dynamics that we experience in the creation are dual, right? In other words, what I'm knowing right now, you're not knowing. Or I have a different perception. Each one of us right now, this moment, has totally different perception. We're a totally different angle. We're all seeing something different. We're all thinking something different. We're all hearing something different. Because we're hearing from a different place and we're focused on different things. It's all unique. So the seer and the seen. There are many seers and many seers and many seens. Just in this room alone. Right? And now if you say Brahman is a seer, which seer is he going to be? Knowing that one, because of which all things are known. Yeah. If Brahman has eyes, right? Does Brahman have eyes? That's the thing. Does Brahman have a set of ears? If he has eyes and he has a set of ears, then what are those eyes and ears stuck on? Yes, it's just a set of ears flying around or some eyes. You know? Because flying eyes, you know. So if Brahman has ears or has eyes, then he has to have something which those ears and eyes are stuck on, right? And so he becomes a limited being within the creation, right? And so here that is made very clear. Brahman has no ears and has no eyes. Brahman is not a knower. Now think of it like this. If you have a dream or imagine, say you have a dream. In the dream, there are many knowers and there are many knowns. They all belong to the dream, right? The knower-known dichotomy belongs to the dream. Everybody with me on that? Now, you are the dreamer. You're not even identified with a character in the dream, say. Well, it wouldn't matter anyway, but you are the dreamer. The entire dream is known, sarvajñaha. The entire dream that you're having is known. Where are your ears and eyes that allow that dream to be known? There are characters in the dream that have ears and eyes, right? And they are hearing through their ears and seeing through their eyes, the characters in the dream. But for you, the dreamer, the whole dream is known without any ears and without any eyes. That's sarvajñaha sarvavit. The entire thing is known. But there is no knower-known relationship in terms of ears and eyes. We'll get on to that a little bit later, but let's just leave it there for now. So a chakshush, when you say chakshush srotram, that's a compound. Eyes and ears with the in front. A chakshush srotram without eyes and ears, okay? Tad that, apanipadam. Now, it continues. It not only has no eyes and ears, it has no hands or feet. in the first part, it says Brahman is not something that can be grasped, you know, by the karmendriyas, by the organs of action. It's agrahyam. It can't be grasped. It can't be touched. There's nothing you can do to it. But now it says, but maybe Brahman, you can't do any, Brahman can't be touched, but maybe Brahman can touch. Maybe Brahman can walk. Maybe Brahman can evacuate. Maybe Brahman can have sex. Maybe, you know, maybe Brahman can, has all of the karmendriyas and can exercise those, but then he can't be touched. No. Brahman has no hands upon me. Padam. Brahman has no feet. Brahman has no hands or feet. Brahman has no karmendriyas. Okay? So now, we have to look at what has just been done. We have just removed the world from Brahman. Really. Brahman not only is not something that can be perceived or touched in the world, Brahman is also something that does not perceive or touch. See that? So this dual, this duality of seer seen, of participation in the creation as an object within the creation, that is not there for Brahman. Right? So Brahman is now, that the creation or the participation as an object in the creation has been eliminated for Brahman. All the way down to the knowership. Now, in that elimination, what has been eliminated in terms of Brahman for yourself, who are you? Because Shanaka goes to the teacher and says to the teacher, to Bhagavan, hey Bhagavan, please teach me that which, knowing which, all things are known. Knowing which, I become a sattva of it, somebody who knows all things. Please teach me what that thing is. Well, now what we know, that thing that is called the Brahmavidya, the Paravidya, that thing is not going to have anything to do with your body or anybody else's body, with your form or anybody else's form. It's not going to have to do with any your sense organs or anybody else's sense organs, whether they be your sense organs or a devata's sense organs, your sense organs or a devata's sense organs, right? Or a devata's body. It's not going to have anything to do with the karmendriyas. And so basically what has been eliminated is both the physical body and the subtle body, right? Because the karmendriyas and the five sense organs belong to the subtle body. So if you get rid of these things, you've, for the most part, gotten rid of the entire sukshma sharira. And so all of these things now have been eliminated from the nature of Brahman. And so now, after this elimination, he says, that Brahman, which is not any of these things, it is nityam. Okay? Nityam means, before it said agotram, means Brahman was not ever born, it has no lineage, it has not been born. Nityam means it's free from time, means it has no end either. But really, to understand nityam, don't think of it in terms of eternal. Think of it in nityam in terms of that which is free from time. It is not subject to change. It has no beginning. It has no end. It hasn't come into being. It is. It hasn't come into being because it's a gotra. Having not had being, it is, but it hasn't been born. It is without having been born. Having not been born, it is, therefore it is free from change, that makes it nityam. So the Brahman which is now is the Brahman that always has been. And it's not has been in terms of has been. It's the Brahman that is the Brahman that is. The you that is there now is the you that is always there. There is no time involved. So the self that I am is free from time. So the self that I am right now is indestructible. It's aksharam. That's why aksharam Brahman. So Brahman is nityam, free from time. Right? Because non-objectifiable, right? Unborn, non-objectifiable. Because of this agrahyam, you know, adrishyam, agrahyam, all of these. So you are non-objectifiable. You're free from time. And you are vibhum. Now, vibhum means vividam bhavati. That which comes into being, that from which everything comes, that which becomes manifest, in this infinite creation. Okay. So now we have Brahman, which is changeless, Nityam, that manifests as this entire creation, Vibhum. The Upanishad's going to have to develop this so that you understand it. But that's literally what Vibhum means. That which manifests as Vividam, as all that is. It manifests all this duality. That which comes into being as all of this is Vibhum. And being Vibhum, having manifested as all of this, it is Sarvagatam. It is all pervasive. Akashavat, like space. It's all pervasive like space, except, let's look at this. So we've got Vibhum, that which manifests as all of this, which is all pervasive because it is Brahman, which manifests as all of this. Right? And because it is Brahman that manifests as all of this, Brahman is not away from all of this. Brahman is all of this. It's kind of like saying the example is the good old clay pot. You know, the clay manifests. If you were to say this clay manifests as a pot, right? Then you say, and therefore, the clay is all pervasive to the pot. It's that kind of all pervasive. When we use the example of space, of Akasha, there's a little problem there. Because Akasha is not the material cause of the rug, or of the pot, or of the chair, or the table, or this cup. The space of all pervasive, it goes through everything. We'll say, like, there's only one Akasha, there's only one space. Space is Sarvagatam. It's all pervasive. So we could say, like, for instance, this room space. But actually, space pervades this room to the outside. And it pervades Berkeley, and it pervades California, and it pervades the United States, and it pervades the Earth, and it pervades the solar system. So space is all pervasive. But then you wouldn't say space is, you know, fire. Space is earth, or space is water. Space is one of the five elements. And so there's a difference in the type of all pervasiveness, because Brahman is the one from whom all of this has come. And so it's all pervasive to all of this, like clay is all pervasive to the pot, or water is all pervasive to the waves, to the ocean. Right? Because water is all pervasive to it because there's nothing there but water. So it's all pervasive. So like that, Brahman, that which knowing which everything is as well known, is all pervasive to this creation, sarvagatam, sarva, everywhere, gatam, has gone. That's a Sanskrit word for all pervasive. It has gone everywhere. So Brahman is all pervasive to this creation because this creation is nothing but Brahman. Right? Just like the pot is nothing but clay, or the ocean is nothing but water. Like that, all of this entire creation, which has come from Brahman, is nothing but Brahman. So Brahman is Vibhum and Sarvagatam. And then Brahman is Susukshmam. It is the most subtle. Sukshmam means subtle. Susukshmam means the most subtle. The subtle, subtler than the subtle. Susukshman, very subtle. Okay. Now, what that means is that when we look at this whole manifest creation, which you say it's manifest through Maya, we haven't got into that in the Upanishad yet, but this whole manifest creation, Brahman manifests as this creation having undergone no change itself, because Nityam, free from birth, free from change. So when Brahman manifests as this creation, it manifests without itself undergoing any change whatsoever. And that's where Maya comes in. So now, when we say it is susukshman, this creation manifests initially as the five subtle elements, space, air, fire, water, earth. Those five subtle elements go through a process of panchikaranam to become fivefold, to become physical, physicalized. So they go through this process of physicalization to become the physical world. And so now, the five subtle elements themselves, which are responsible for the mind and the sense, or the mind, the buddhi, which are made of the five subtle elements, All the sense organs, they're made of the five subtle elements. The organs of action are the rajas aspect of the five elements. Those five subtle elements, which then go through a process of grossification to become the physical world, those five subtle elements come from Brahman. And so Brahman is the material cause, the very being of those elements, the five subtle elements. And so being the very being of the five subtle elements, it is more subtle than even the subtle elements. So it is more subtle than the subtlest. Now, more subtle than the subtlest. What is the subtlest in our experience? Well, we would say that which is the most pervasive and the innermost. For instance, the physical world is perceived by my sense organs, so they are not innermost, right? And my sense organs need to be more subtle than the objects themselves. They have to be able to pervade the objects. My ears have to be able to pervade space. My eyes have to be able to see through all of this to be able to give me a thought modification. So the sense organs are more subtle than the objects that they perceive. And now we can look like this. The mind is more subtle than the sense organs because the mind is innermost to the sense organs. If the mind doesn't use the sense organs are basically not, they're functioning, but nobody knows it. You don't know it. Your mind is innermost. So what your mind is thinking, right, is what you're perceiving. So if your mind is using your sense organs, right, then the sense organs are known, and what the sense organs perceive are known. If the mind isn't using them, then the sense organs, whatever they're doing, is irrelevant because all that you're experiencing is the mind. And the mind can go vastly beyond the sense organs just through imagination. So we say the mind is more subtle, it has more capacity, it's more inner than even the sense organs. But now the mind itself, it itself is known. It itself is pervaded by consciousness, right? The consciousness, the being, the existence in the being which illumines the mind, right, is innermost to the mind. Right? Because the being, the conscious being, doesn't go away. It pervades the mind. You can't have a mind that is away from consciousness. You can't have a mind that's away from being. Right? And the mind can't get rid of the conscious. It can get rid of itself. It can change one, replace one thought with another thought, that type of thing. But there's nothing it can do to you. There's nothing it can do to consciousness, to existence. A consciousness existence just abides. It just stays there and pervades whatever experience is being happened. And pervades means what? There's no part of the experience that's away from it. And actually, when we start to analyze it, again, when we think of pervades, we give some sort of reality to the creation that, in fact, the creation doesn't deserve. In this sense, the same sense that the pot, the clay, doesn't pervade the pot, your consciousness doesn't pervade the thought or pervade the world. The world has no being whatsoever apart from your consciousness. But the consciousness doesn't change as the world changes. It doesn't change as the thoughts change. But the very warp and woof of the thought, of the perception, of the sense organ, of whatever I'm experiencing, the very warp and woof of it is consciousness alone. And so in that way, this consciousness which is innermost is outermost also. You have to say, if you say about the clay pot, the clay is innermost. It's the innermost self of the pot. Right? But really, there's nothing there but clay. And yet we have this pot to deal with. So really, there's nothing there but me, my being, and we have this universe to deal with. How do you deal with it? Well, we're dealing with it. How we are dealing with it is to understand what is actually going on, to understand what actually this is, to understand that this is nothing but myself. And if I understand that my being is the very self of all of this, and that my being is changeless, then knowing this, all of this is as well known. But I have to know this as it is. If I think, say if you take vibhum, and you haven't understood all of the rest, you take vibhum to mean that the Atma, Brahman, manifests as all of this. And now it's gone. Now it's all of this. Right? Brahman has manifested all of this. And do you think of it in terms of, it says changed into all of this. Then to know Brahman, you have to know all of this. There's no possibility of knowing all of this. You can't even know one thing. You can't even know one thing completely. So that if there's no Brahman left, because Brahman has become all of this, what one thing of all of this are you going to know so that all things can be as well known? Or say Brahman, you know, has duplicated himself by having children. Well, what child, you know, and then Brahman dies off and there's a bunch of children. Swami uses this example. You know, Brahman is the cause, gives birth to a lot of kids, dies off. So he's become all of this, all these children. So which child are you going to know, knowing which all things are as well known? See, it's not possible. You have to know, in order for this statement to be possible, knowing that which all things are as well known, there has to be something which is one. One without a second. To be known, which is the very being and the truth of all things. Like if I were to say, if I know gold, I know the truth of all gold ornaments. If I know clay, I know the truth of all clay pots. Yeah? If I know water, I know the truth of the ocean. I know what is actually there. So what here is like that? Knowing which all things are known. So here, this Brahman, which is being already said, it's not something that you can know or perceive or grasp, or it's not itself a knower, it has no hands, it has no legs. It's nityam. It's something that's free from free from change. It is this Aksharam Brahman from which this whole creation has come, which is sarvagatam, which means is the very being of all of this creation, susukshmam, the most subtle, tad avyayam. That Brahman is avyayam. Means navyeti. Avyayam means it can't wane, it can't change, it can't perish, because it has no limbs. Your body can grow old. Your body is not avyayam. Your body has limbs. Those limbs will wear out, they'll diminish and decay. Brahman has no limbs. Avyayam can also be like, they use the example of a king. The kosha, the jewels, or the wealth of a king, you know, can dissipate and be lost. You can lose your wealth, you know, and in that way be diminished because you've lost your wealth. Brahman has no wealth other than being all, right? Because being all, there's nothing that can be lost. There's no specific thing, right? If Brahman is the very non-dual being from which all things come, it has nothing apart from itself to lose. Let me put it this way. There is nothing other than itself to be lost. There's nowhere for anything to go because there is nothing else. And so there's no one to take it away. There are no parts, right? And so there can be no diminishment in that way. And so, in that sense, avyayam, either the decay of the self or the loss of wealth, there's no change at all for diminishment for Brahman. And it's that Brahman which is bhuta yonim, the cause for all beings. Bhuta means beings. Yoni means the cause. So when we say vibhum, we're talking about the one who is the material cause, what we call the upadana karanam, the very being, the very existence, which is the being of all of this. When we say bhuta yonim, we mean, yoni means the womb. For a woman, the yoni is the womb, that which from which the birth comes. So Brahman is the yoni, the womb, for all birth. So there we use for that the nimitta karanam means from this conscious being, from the conscious being which is Brahman, all beings have come. And so we've got both the upadana karana and the nimitta karana. So it's like this creation is not only, it is a this creation is nothing but consciousness. It's nothing but consciousness, conscious existence. That's the upadana karana, the material cause. This creation is a conscious being. That's the nimitta karana. See the difference? Like if you say, this creation is nothing but pure consciousness. It is only consciousness. Then you're talking about this creation, the substance of it. But then when you say, this creation, which is only pure consciousness, is a conscious being, then you say, you're saying, the nimitta karanam, that this is just, there's no such thing as inert consciousness. So then this whole conscious creation as bhuta yonim, with the words are trying to convey there, is that this creation, which is nothing but consciousness, is a conscious being. You are a conscious being. You would never say about yourself that you are not a conscious being, but that you are a conscious being. When you get to, though, the actual nature of yourself, the conscious being that you are, you recognize that the conscious being that you are doesn't have hands or legs. It doesn't have eyes or ears. It doesn't have a name or form. All of these instruments belong to the whole Maya Upadi, which is itself nothing but consciousness in terms of its being. But you yourself, who are a conscious being, are the one from whom all of this comes. As a dreamer, the whole dream comes from you, right? The eyes and the ears and the perceptions and the knownness of the dream, all of that comes from you. So you are a conscious being, right? From which the whole comes. And when the whole comes in reference to the dream, you are a conscious being from whom the whole comes. And when the whole comes, you are a conscious being. And the whole is known. You, the conscious being, with or without the whole, with or without the creation, are a conscious being. When the creation is here, which has come from you, that creation is known, sarvajnam sarvavit. You are all knowledge. When the creation is an unmanifest condition and not here, you are still a conscious being. You are all knowledge, right? Without the manifestation of the creation. And so here, that's what Brahman, the Brahman that you are, right, is the being which is all of this and is the cause for all of this. Just like you are the being when you have a dream, you are the being which is the being and the consciousness which the dream enjoys. You are the very substance of the dream that has no being at all apart from you. And you are the cause, the consciousness from which this dream has come. You are the, put it this, you are the conscious being from which this dream has come. And when that dream is there, you are that conscious being. That's Ishwara. You're the Ishwara of the dream. You are the one from whom the dream has come. When the dream is there, then, that is your form. Right? When the dream has come, that's your body. That's your form. When the dream resolves, then the dream is just not there. That's all right. It's an unmanifest condition. It's still you. Right? You remain exactly the same. You don't become the dream in the sense that your being does not convert into the dream. But the dream has no being apart from you. So like that, the Bhagavan, the Brahman, does not become the creation, does not transform into the creation, but is the self, which is the very stuff of the creation, right, which sustains the creation, and into which the creation resolves. So Brahman is both the stuff, all-pervasive to the creation, because the very cause of the creation, like the clay pot, and the conscious being from whom the creation comes. Then, paripashyanti dhiraha, the persons who have this knowledge, this viveka, they know this very clearly. Paripashyanti, they see it completely clearly. There's no vagueness. There's no doubt. And that's what the nature of Brahman. So now, having talked about this paravidya and what it exactly is the nature of Brahman, now he has to, the Upanishad has to unfold all of this to make the student understand that paripashyanti, so that you become a dhira, dhiraha paripashyanti, so that you become one who sees this completely, clearly. Sees it means that you know yourself, that you recognize yourself as this. That's what it is. Okay, so let's take a stop there. Let's take a moment. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Yeah, it is. It is. And then does the negation, complete negation of the whole creation, really. And then it does positive assertion with Nityam, you know, and Sarvagatam and Vibhum and all of this. It doesn't just leave you with the neti neti. It does that first. Yeah. It's very complete. It's a beautiful Upanishad. Because it takes it to the takes it back to Ishvara, talks about the sampradaya, talks about the teaching, tradition of teaching, talks about both the Upayanishta and Upayanishta, where the Upayanishta is for the Antakarana Shuddhi, the purity of mind, you know. And then the Paravidya. And now from now on, of course, it's talking about Brahman.
The dream analogy you do, it's getting clearer and clearer to me. It's very beautiful. But I still have a thing with so there's a dream analysis, and I can see that it comes from me, sustained by me, and dissolved by me. What does that have to do with relationships? I don't get the concept of Brahman in that. You know,
okay.
I mean? Is that too big, or is it?
No. Now, it's an illustration that of an experience that you have, every individual has, which is a limited experience because my dream is different from your dream, right? And also, when I'm having a dream, I don't necessarily, unless it's a lucid dream, I don't necessarily know that I'm dreaming. And so the dream analogy has certain limitations, but there it has things that are not limitations, and that's what we're pointing to. And this is what it is. When you have a dream, you are having an experience of yourself as Ishvara, in the sense that you as the dreamer, right, are the one from whom the whole has come, the whole dream has come. You're having that experience, right? And when you're having that experience, you are the self of the whole dream and all of the characters in it. You're the material cause of the dream. Right, it's your Maya from whom the dream has come. You're the material cause of the dream. You are every character in the dream. You're every situation in the dream. You're the one self that pervades the dream. You're the very substance and being in the dream. And you have this Maya capacity to make this creation, and this creation resolves into you. So you have that experience on a limited level as an individual. Now, say if you take that experience, and now we look at it on a total level. You have Brahman, which is just pure consciousness, which in fact is your being. But now we're not looking at Brahman with the limited Maya that is differentiated by your mind, your mind, your mind, your mind. It's limited, right? But you're still Maya, but you don't have the whole Maya under your control. You have your little piece of Maya, right? But say you have Brahman that has the entire Maya capacity. So the self then with the Maya projects as the entire infinite creation. So now what does that mean? Just like the relationship you have with the dream, where you are the self of everything in the dream, the entire dream is known, right, in consciousness. The dream resolves into you. Like that, the self with the whole Maya capacity projects as the infinite creation, the whole of which is known, with them, and which is the self. You are the Brahman, is the self of everything in that creation, from all of the creatures to all of the ants and the worms and the human beings and the devatas, right? And the very being of all of the rocks and the space, all of the elements. You are the very being of all of that. So all this dream analogy is doing is trying to make you see in your experience how in reference, this limited reference of your relationship to a dream, how you are the Ishwara of that dream, in reality, away from the dream now, the self, yourself, is the Ishwara of the entire creation. But now, the ones who are gaining knowledge, you, all of you sitting before me, giving you this knowledge, this teacher-student relationship is taking place within this room, all of us are within this infinite creation. But in reality, the self from whom this infinite creation has come is just me. There's only one me. When you say me, you say me, you say me, these are all minds saying, I am, I am, I am, I am. These minds are all referring to the one self, which in fact I am. But there's only one of me. Right? And so, the me that you're enjoying right now, when you say me, you are that me, that is you. But there's only one. Right, so that me, which is you, is the only me that is there. So your me experience, you know the me experience when you say, I am, I exist, me, 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 me. That's all true, that is you. But it's all of us. But then there are all of these minds. You have everybody saying, I am Mia, I am, I am, I am. Those are the minds just labeling the one self from whom the whole has come. So I am you. I'm not like you. We're not twins. I am you. And this being that I am is the one that from whom this entire creation has come. And now the problem is that the jivas, all of us, are within the creation saying, with because of self-ignorance, saying, well, who am I? Right? And so that's why this sampradaya, this tradition of teaching, is said to come from Ishwara. Now, imagine, you're the dreamer. You're having a dream. Okay? You're having a dream, and there are a lot of characters and a lot of activity going on in the dream. You're the Ishwara of the dream. And then, one of the characters in the dream prays to you. To you as the Lord. They don't know who you are. They just believe there's a God there. But they right? And they say, please, if you're there, I remember saying this prayer. Please, if you're there, you know, save me. Please, you know. Get me a teacher, because I had heard about a guru. There was such a thing. Please save me. You know? Because I didn't know. I didn't even know what God was or if God, I believed there was a God. But.
You asked for a teacher.
Mm-hmm. I will. Most of us have asked for a teacher, asked for someone. Okay, so. Now, say you're the Ishwara. And now one character in the dream, who of course is you, right, your creation reality, is saying, please save me, help me. You're the conscious being. What are you going to do? Give him a teacher. Yeah. Why not?
You wake up and dream dismissed.
Before going out.
Yeah.
Would I be experiencing the all-knowing the way Brahma?
Not from the stand, no.
Because this, I'm still limited, right?
Yeah. No, yeah. As this upadi, body, mind, sense organs, this upadi can only experience the limited scope that it's capable of experiencing. That's why we use the dream analogy, because in the dream analogy, you can see what it would be like to be all-knowing in reference to the dream, where you look at the dream creation, okay, and the dream creation, while it's there, that's all that exists, that's the universe. That dream is the infinite universe. There is nothing else. There's just the infinite universe there. That infinite universe is known to you. You're the Ishwara of that infinite universe that we call the dream. That's how we use that illustration. So from the standpoint of Ishwara, the infinite universe is known like your little infinite dream universe is known. But from the standpoint of anything within the creation, any upadhi, then that upadhi is limited by the confines of that, by the nature of the upadhi. So that upadhi will not have limitless knowledge. You can have what we call sarvajnam. The jiva can have sarvajnam, means knowing that which all things are as well known, because you can know yourself. And yourself is the very being of all things. But you can't be a sarvavit. You can't have particular knowledge of, you know, everything that exists within the creation. Because that would require, you know, an infinite mind. And you don't have an infinite mind. So that's only the individual jiva upadis are not capable of that type of particular knowledge. That's the Ishwara. So for liberation, when there is no more limited upadhi, then you are just the whole. Whatever is Ishwara's experience is your experience. Because you are Ishwara. You're not seen through the lens of an upadhi. This jiva, body, mind, sense organs, is as long as it is here, its experience will be a limited experience. Your self-experience is not limited. Your self-experience, the self that you are, is Brahman. It's not part of Brahman. It's that Brahman has no parts. You know, it's not an aspect of Brahman, it is Brahman. So that is the whole. But your experience of the creation is limited.
So if this limited body and mind
is
gone, then I will, and I know I'm the Atman, right?
Yeah, well, when the limited...
Then I will know everything.
Yeah. When
the body's dead.
Mm-hmm. Well, when there is no more body, when there's no more ahankara, when there's no more subtle body, when there's no more transmigration of the jiva, then you are the whole. So what is the experience of the whole? It is whatever that experience is. Whatever Brahman's experience is in reference to the whole, that is your experience. And so we give you an example to help you imagine what that would be. When you are having a dream and you're not identified with a character in the dream, then you're just the whole. So whatever that whole is, we don't know what that is, experience is, in terms of the infinite creation. We know exactly what it is right now, even with this limited body, in terms of yourself. There, yourself is yourself, period. That's not going to come or go or change. When this body dies, it doesn't make any difference.
So when Swamiji says, I am the whole.
What he's doing when he says, I am the whole, is breaking down this subject-object differentiation. I'm both the subject and the object. There's nothing here that is not me. You know, it's like in the wave ocean. You know, the water is everything that is there. Like that, I am the whole means I'm the seer, I'm the seen. I'm the knower, I'm the known. I'm the subject, I'm the object. I'm the very, this whole creation is my being. That includes not only what is known to the sense organs, but it includes the sense organs themselves. It includes the mind. It includes everything that exists within duality. I am the very being, the very whole of that. So now if you use, again, the dream analogy, when the dream comes, there's all of this division within the dream. There's the knower, the known, the hearer, the heard, the subject and the object. When you say, I am the whole, then you're saying, I am the hearer, I am the heard. I am the subject, I am the object. There is nothing that is not my being. That's what we mean. I am the whole. If I look at you right now and say, I am the subject, I am the object. I am this person, I am me and I am you. So if you think about it, if you can say I'm the subject and the object, I'm the seer and I'm the seen, that's it.
But what, I'm really coming up against a whole bunch of stuff all of a sudden, because I've been walking around thinking that the whole, I am the whole, means I'm as fast as this universe, as the galaxies and everything. But that's the problem, right? That's the limit.
Well, you know what? That is also true. When you say I am the whole and you think of the whole infinite creation, that's true. You are that.
As well.
But there's no creation in Brahman. There is no creation.
No, but there's but this creation has no being apart from Brahman. So here we are enjoying the creation. What is this creation? This creation is Brahman. We won't say Brahman is this creation because Brahman doesn't become this creation. But this creation has no being apart from Brahman. So it's like saying, you know, the clay is not the pot, but the pot is the clay. You say the clay is not the pot because if you wreck the pot, the clay is still there. The clay doesn't become the pot. You say, you know, the snake is the rope because it's totally dependent on the rope. The rope's not the snake. But from the standpoint of the snake, you know, the illusion of the snake on the rope, there is no snake without the rope. But the rope, from the standpoint of the rope, you know, it's not the snake. Nothing happens to the rope.
So what do you say about the creation?
So this entire creation is myself. It has no being apart from me. But I don't go through any type of modification to become this creation. Just like we can use the dream. I don't change to become the dream. I don't modify into the dream. I don't morph into the dream. I don't modify into my thoughts. Right? That's another understanding of I don't become my thoughts. Right, but my thoughts come from me, are sustained by me, and go back into me.
But then, Robert, that's also saying, do I have control over my dreams then? I mean, I go to bed and decide I'm going to have a dream tonight?
No, but that's not the point, Peter. Now you're going outside and as though we're talking about dreams. We're only using the dream phenomena to make you have an experiential understanding of what we mean when we're talking about Brahman and the Maya.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to the Anna, the mind now.
Yeah. Instead of just using it as something to help you see, you know, as a tool, like to help you see. It's like what you have on in a limited way, you know, Brahman has on an absolute and a total way. So we have a little, you know, just that we have the dream is such a wonderful thing to make you understand, because you have a little bit, but Brahman has totally. You know?
Somebody said, I wonder if you were there, when he said, as if we have the dream, for using that example.
Yeah. I was there.
Yeah,
you said that before us.
What is that?
You know, Swamiji was saying in class in Coimbatore, he was saying it's as though Bhagavan gave us dreams just to have it to be able to use as a teacher. Because it's so beautiful, it's so perfect, you know. Because you really understand Maya. Even in psychology, you know, projection, the capacity to project, you see something that is not there and you respond to it. Is it so real, you know? And then when you see that, oh, that was just my projection, then all of the nightmare of it goes. Yeah.
God, that was a verse.
God. You're so lucky, amazing. Yeah.
Should we call it a night?
Yeah, thank you again. So we miss next Sunday, right?